So what I'm going to present today is some of the work that I've been doing for the last 4 or 5 years revolving around risky choice, and particularly thinking about risky choice from the point of view of strategies and how people differ in terms of how they approach the same kinds of problems. I have a little bit of an ambitious plan. Hopefully I'll get through it, but I want to talk about three broad areas of research that are all sort of interconnected, and I will try to put them all together at the end. Basically, first I want to introduce a study that would be the broad focus of my talk today, where we'll talk about how people actually vary strategically in how they make decisions in the context of a risky choice task. Then what I'll try to do is I'll try to tie some of the findings in neuroscience from this study into a broader role of cognitive control. Like, how can experiments in decision neuroscience and risky choice help in the broader picture of how people think about the brain, especially in terms of cognitive control? So that would be like the second focus. And lastly, I'd talk a little bit about some other work that I do related to sleep deprivation in the context of how things that we learn in terms of mechanisms from these risky choice studies can actually apply to other areas, be it state changes like emotions, or be it state changes like sleep deprivation, or even talking about things like aging and so on. Like, how can you take these mechanisms from these simple lab-based studies and develop it into broader predictions for other areas, like what's the effect of emotions and so on and so forth. So that's the idea of introducing this over here. All right, so without further ado, so let me talk a little bit about decision making. So all of us are exposed to a broad variety of decisions every day. Okay. Now, the slight differentiation that I want to make here is basically one between what I called a choice, which is essentially how you choose between several alternatives that's available to you, and a strategy. Okay. And I know there are several definitions of strategy, but for the purpose of what I do, I define strategy basically as how, as an individual, you represent and evaluate all the information that's available to you towards making the eventual decision, right? So the manner in which you process all the information and decide on what you eventually want to choose, that's what I define as strategy for the purpose of what I'm going to talk about today. Okay? So when we talk about strategic variability, it basically refers to the variability in how people process information. Okay, so that's what I call strategic variability. And it can be explored from two broad areas. One is what I call a within subject variability. Okay, so this is basically how you change what you do based on simple changes in the environment. The context changes, what you do now as a graduate student, and some of you might be very different from what you do once you have a full-time faculty position, right? It's the same individual. It's usually the same amount of information that's available to you, but your preference has changed because the environment has changed literally, right? So that's what I refer to as either context, or other cases it could also be state changes. On a day that you're in a good mood, you may do something differently from when you're having a really crappy day, right? And again, the information that's available to you is the same, but your decision might vary. And you could also have variability that's between subjects. So this is where you have differences in traits, differences in personalities, and so what people do would be completely different, again, given the same problem and same context. Okay? So variability can be of two types. One is things that are within an individual, and another one is things that are between individuals. Okay? And we want to try and understand a little bit about both these different types of variabilities. Essentially, what we want to try and do is to characterize how people approach a problem and how they bring different kinds of information to bear when they're solving these problems. Okay? All right. So that brings me to the task that is going to be common through all the studies that I'm talking to you today about, so I'm going to spend some time explaining it. Basically, it goes like this. Essentially, everybody is presented initially with a complex gamble of this form. So it's got 5 outcomes and 5 different probabilities. Okay? So the way to understand this gamble is basically you have a 1/5 chance of winning $80. A 1/5 chance, and then like a 25% chance of winning $40. A 20% chance of winning nothing, a 15% chance of losing 25, and a 20% chance of losing 70. Okay? So basically, the structure is there are 5 different outcomes. Each outcome has its own probability associated with it. Okay? Now, I give you this gamble, and then I tell you, if I gave you an additional set of house money, okay, such that you can improve this gamble, right? So let's say I want to give you $15 of house money, and I ask you, which one of these outcomes do you want to improve? Okay? You can either add that money to the highest gain, so you can make the $80 as now $95, okay? I call it a gain maximizing choice. You're trying to maximize the highest gain when you do it. Or you could be somebody who's loss averse in general. You could say, I want to remove the effect of the worst loss, so you can add it to the worst loss and reduce it to $55 loss instead of a $70 loss. Okay? So I quite simply call it a loss minimizing choice. A third option, which is psychologically interesting and the one that would form the emphasis of my talk today, is to add the money to this middle outcome over here, which is essentially starting at zero. Okay? Now what this does is, in terms of the overall chances of winning something from this gamble, initially you had a 45% chance of walking away with something positive. Okay? The magnitudes don't matter, the individual probabilities don't matter. We are now looking in the context of the whole gamble. There was a 45% chance of winning something initially, and when you make this change, you increase that to 65% chance of winning something. Okay? 65% chance of walking away with something positive from this gamble, essentially, when you do this change. So for that reason, we call it a probability of winning maximizing choice, or a PMAX choice. Okay? So what this does is essentially focuses on the valence of the entire gamble. So how can I improve my overall chance of walking away with something positive? Okay? And as you will see later, it works very well whether you're going from zero to positive, whether you're going from negative to zero, which means you're reducing your overall chance of losing, or when you're going from negative to positive, which is again changing your overall chances of winning. Right? But as long as there is some change in either the probability of winning or the probability of not losing, you would still see this effect, which we call the probability maximizing effect. Okay? So we have three different choices. And again, for the purpose of the fMRI experiment that I'll talk to you later about, where it's a lot easier to design a two-choice experiment, what we'll do is in some trials, you make a choice between the loss and the Pmax. So even though you have a five-outcome gamble, the decision you're making is pretty straightforward. Do you want to go with adding money to the middle outcome, or do you want to go with adding money to the loss outcome? And in other trials, do you want to go with adding money to the middle outcome, or do you want to go with adding money to the highest gain outcome? Right? So it boils down to a very simple two-choice option, where in the context of this complex gamble, if you had to just improve between a constrained set of options, which one do you choose? That's basically the task that a subject is doing. Yeah. So just to introduce, like I said, what would some models predict in these cases? You could work through the equations for expected utility theory, and if the two choices that I had to make were between gamble A and gamble B, so in this case, it is a gain-maximizing choice. In this case, it's a probability-maximizing choice. So basically, those are the two differences in this particular option. You would basically see that expected utility would predict that you should go with gamble A. Okay? And you can work the math with cumulative prospect theory too, and you would basically find the same. So both those theories would predict that in this case, you should be going with gamble A. Okay? But what we find in a lot of studies that we do, so just to recap, you have two choices over here that seem to be more consistent with what I would call some kind of a compensatory strategy that's consistent with some economic models, like the predictions of current or popular economic models, what they would predict, right? So I call this a compensatory strategy because you trade off between the various outcomes, and then I also call it like essentially you focus on the magnitudes and it's sort of like a value maximizing choice. And on the other side, you have a simplifying strategy that's just based on the simple heuristic. The magnitudes don't matter. All you care about is like what's the overall chance of winning. So for that reason, I call it a simple non-compensatory or simplifying strategy that's focused on the overall probability of winning. Okay? And what we find is basically in two different studies that involved about 200 subjects, we saw a very strong overwhelming preference for the probability maximizing choice. In other words, across subjects, about 70% of the trials, people preferred this probability maximizing strategy, which would be, of course, inconsistent with the predictions of expected utility and cumulative prospect theory. So what we do is we actually make the subjects play these things for real. And the way we implement it is we do a percentage multiplier for these gambles, which the subjects are not aware of before they start. So the way it works is if you're a subject, you come in to do these experiments, we give you an envelope that has some money in it, which is an endowment in case you end up with a loss. And it also tells them on a sheet of paper like what the multiplier would be applied for all these gambles. Okay, because we don't want to give them a $100 endowment for every single subject. That would cost us a lot of money. right? So the multiplier we used was a 10% multiplier, but of course the subjects don't know what the multiplier is and how much endowment is there, except they know that they have an endowment, and some of these trials would be played out for real, and if they lose money, they basically would lose from their endowment. If they win, they keep the endowment and also whatever they win, right? So let's say for these, we randomly picked two trials from the study and we implemented it. So we give them a $20 endowment, which would cover for the worst case two outcomes that are $100 losses or whatever it is. So they get a $20 endowment. They make all these choices. They are told that some random set of two trials would be selected. So they have no idea of knowing which two trials will be selected. So that way we emphasize that please treat each one as if it's an independent decision problem. When they finish, we randomly use like a roll of a die to decide which problem gets selected. And then we do like a spinner to see like what the outcome randomly selected for that one is. And based on that, we either give them additional money or we take away from their endowment. So that's the basic data across two different studies. Then we asked ourselves, like, how much of this effect is related to this zero, right? Like, is it something just about being in the middle, sort of like a compromise option? I don't want to worry about the extremes. I'm just going to go with something in the middle. Or is it really about the overall probability? Like, what role does the overall probability make? So what we did for that was we made a very small change. So in some trials, instead of starting at zero, we basically started at five. Or even sometimes we did just $2, right? It's like not a big change in terms of the overall context of the gamble. Like most things still stay the same. But what it does is it takes away that change in the overall probability because it was 65% before and it's still 65%, right? So adding money to this basically is not changing much in terms of the overall probability of winning. So the prediction would be if that's what's driving the effect, then you should see the effect diminish when you do that. Okay? And that's basically what we find. So the preference for this option drops up to about 33% when you do that essentially. So in other words, this tells us that what is driving this effect seems to be the fact that people are focusing on this overall probability of winning. And the last point I want to make on this is it does not have to be in the middle. The same overall probability effect works even if it's at the extremes. Okay? So for example, let me take this gamble and translate it first by adding 70 to all these outcomes. Right? So instead of minus 70, I start with 0, 45, 0, 45, 70, 110, 180. So all I've done is I've translated this gamble by adding 70 to each of these outcomes. So I end up with a gamble like this that I have over here. And then I give you the choice of adding 15 to the middle outcome or adding 15 to the lowest outcome in this case. Okay? Now notice what's happened is now this is the probability maximizing outcome because when you do that, you change your overall probability from 80% of winning something before to a sure shot of winning something from this gamble. Okay? So in this case, you should see a preference for this, not the one in the middle. And that's basically what we find. So this is the probability maximizing choice, and it's even more. It's close to 80% when you do that. So it's an exaggerated effect by putting it in the extremes. And we find it both when you go from a near win to a sure win, or a certain loss to a little bit of a chance of winning. So if you have a full loss gamble, and you could change one outcome to make it a small chance of winning something, you see the same increased effect. Okay? So this basically shows what's driving this effect across all these studies is this focus on the overall probability of winning. Okay? All right. A few other things to note about this. So in general, these choices are slightly faster. So across two studies, you can see that the response time is faster for the probability maximizing choice compared to the other two choices. And consistent with what you would expect with most simplifying strategies, as people learn the environment further and further, the preference for these choices increase. So that's what this line indicates. So if a subject is doing 20 trials of these problems, as you go further into the trial, the proportion of PMAX choices is becoming more and more, or it's increasing in general. All right. And more importantly, is for the purpose of what we want to do, is how do subjects vary, right? Like, is there a consistent pattern across everybody, or are there some people that are very strong PMAX people and some people that are more consistent with what the models would predict, right? So here's a simple histogram in general showing the proportion of PMAX choices, and what you can see is some subjects almost never choose it, like very little, and there is, in general, a right bias. So most people are choosing it, and there are some people who are almost independent of what the expected value trade-off is and so on. They're basically choosing this option that maximizes the probability of winning. Okay? Then we asked ourselves, is this related to some interesting trait measures? Okay? So there were a couple of things that we were looking for. One is just impulsivity, and the other one was like a maximizing satisfying score. The idea is that if you're a maximizer, basically the questions are something like this: when I'm faced with a choice, I try to imagine what all the other possibilities are, and then I choose the one option that finally fits. Like Bob Frank at dinner yesterday, he said that's what he does. Or for example, when you're listening to your car radio, do you pick the first channel that you like, or do you have to go through every single channel and what it's playing, and then you decide which one is the one that works for you, right? So it's a series of questions like this where you give on a scale of 1 to 7 what you would do, and then based on the final scores, you can classify people either as maximizers, so they basically want to know all the various options before they choose, or satisficers, where they pick the first one that they like and essentially leave it there, right? And what we wanted to see was how do these two groups of people essentially vary in their preference for the probability maximizing choice. Now, if our theory about it being a simplifying option is true, then the satisficer should prefer more Pmax, and the maximizer should go with basically the more value maximizing options. And that's basically what we find. So the proportion of Pmax choices is significantly higher for the satisficers relative to the maximizers within our population. So basically, individuals demonstrate variability as a function of what changes you make in the context, like whether or not EV is same, whether or not Pmax choice is available, and so on, as well as set of underlying traits, right? Then the next question is, like, is this variability really associated with some systematic differences in how they process this information, okay? To answer this question, we turn to eye tracking, which is a great tool for trying to understand the underlying process. How are people accessing this information? What are they doing with this kind of information? Okay, so we simplified the presentation of the problem to something like a nice table format where all the three choices are now available to the participants. It's presented in the form of a grid where there is one option that's clearly Gmax, one option that's Pmax, and one option that's loss minimizing. Okay, these color changes and these labels are, of course, just for illustration. They're not in what the actual subject sees. Okay, we also randomized which one is which. So these alternatives are randomized in this experiment. And we also basically randomized the order in which the rows and columns are because we wanted to control for the reading effect. So some subjects see it as is shown here. Other subjects, the labels will be G1, G2, G3 this way, and the attributes are going this way. Essentially transpose this entire grid. So in the first study, they are lined up. So it's always going to go in a rank order format where the gains are here, the intermediate outcomes are here, and the losses are here. It does introduce a confound which we control in a study, and I'll show you how the data changes based on that. Okay, so basically something like this, and essentially what you can do is you can record what the subjects are looking at. So, I mean, a simple animation would look something like this. This is actually a subject's trial, but just put into a simple PowerPoint kind of an animation. Subjects are processing across these different cells. You can look at first how long they're spending on each of these cells. You can look at what order or what sequence they are going between these various cells. Okay. And also you can get additional information like their pupil dilation, like how much is the pupil dilated based on the magnitude or how much effort they are putting into it, and so on and so forth. For the purpose of what I'm going to present today, I'm going to focus on three measures. One is basically how many acquisitions do you make, right? So how much information do you process? How much unique information do you process? The second one is how much time do you spend on each of these different cells? Because they carry different amount of information, and depending on what you're going to choose, different things are going to be more or less important to you for the eventual choice that you're going to make. And the third thing that's very diagnostic of some of these different strategies that people could use is how much do you go within an alternative versus how much do you go within attributes, right? So the idea is, for example, if you're doing an expected value, in the sense of expected value, you would basically go across this, you would calculate an expected value for G1, you would calculate expected value for G2, you'd calculate an expected value for G3, and basically choose the one that's highest expected value, right? Or if you're using a simple heuristic that says minimize the effect of the worst loss independent of what you're doing, you would basically go to the loss column, that's the priority heuristic basically, you would see which one is the best in terms of the loss and essentially end up choosing that particular option, okay? So just the sequence in which people process is highly diagnostic of a lot of different models. You can make specific predictions, process-based predictions for what these models would say, and then you can go and look at, is that what the process data says? Is that what the subjects are doing, right? For example, priority heuristic, which is another very common heuristic, would predict that subjects don't really pay much attention to the probabilities as long as they are different in terms of the magnitudes. So if you see in your process that people are going back between the amounts and the probabilities, then that would be a violation of what the priority heuristic prediction would be. Okay? So you can make very clear process predictions, and you can look at the data and you can see basically what the data says, whether or not it's consistent with what each of these different models would predict. Okay, so first choice, it's a busy slide, but basically we are changing expected value, and we are changing whether or not the middle outcome starts at zero or starts at already a positive value. So what you can see is, there is a very strong available, non-available effect. So Pmax is really high in these trials when the probability maximizing choice is available. It drops when you don't no longer have that option available, right? And then across EV, you still see a very strong Pmax effect, but it's still slightly lesser than what you would see in the unequal EV trials, okay? So the context effect still holds. That's basically the one take-home message from here. Okay, so the first is just looking in terms of number of acquisitions, like totally how much information do you acquire, like how many pieces of information on the screen are you processing before you make your choice. The Pmax is the one that's the lowest number of acquisitions compared to the other two options. Okay, and this would be consistent with just the response time story. In fact, these two measures are very highly correlated. The number of acquisitions that you make, not surprisingly, is related to your overall response time within a trial. Okay, now, next, if we control for the response time within a trial, right? So if let's say you could take different amounts of time on different trials, let's say I normalize everything to a 1 second trial, and I look at within that 1 second, what is it that you're focusing on within each of these different cells, we start seeing some clear differences in terms of where people are focusing their attention, okay? So what we have here is the choice that people make on the trial. So the red means they choose Gmax, blue means they choose Pmax, and green means they choose Lmin. And what we have here is which cells are they focusing their most attention on? Is it the unique cell that corresponds to the highest gain, the unique cell that corresponds to the intermediate outcome, or the unique cell that corresponds to the worst loss? Okay? So what you see from this is basically if you are spending your most effort in your gain maximizing choice, or if you're most likely to choose the gain maximizing choice, that means you have the highest processing of the gain attributes. And if you are mostly going to choose the loss minimizing choice, you have the highest processing of the loss attributes. And the same for the intermediate. Okay? But this is where the question that you raise, confound, comes in. In general, you can see a greater elevated processing of all these three cells, no matter what you're going to choose. Okay? And part of the reason for that is because this is always in the middle column. So even though people can jump across columns, but it sort of becomes like a transition place. When you're going from the gains to losses, you pretty much have to travel through the intermediate outcome in all these different trials. Okay? And that's what explains this greater processing for these outcomes in the intermediate trials. Okay? So to test this explicitly, we did a very simple control experiment where this is the data that I just showed you, but in the second control experiment, we randomized the columns too. So it's no longer going from gain to intermediate to loss. On different trials, basically, you would see different order in which things are presented. Okay? The behavior doesn't change very much. I don't have the data here, but take my word for it. I'm happy to share the data with you. But what we see is this graph here becomes a lot more cleaner, right? So you see very clearly just the Pmax is associated greatest processing for intermediate, the Gmax with gain and loss min for losses. You don't see these two bars essentially come down now because and that essentially addresses the confound. What we have done is the most interesting thing that we have done with this data, I don't have it, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about it, is we break the trial into four quarters in this case, independent of, so let's say you take 15 different acquisitions in a trial. So we bring it into four, 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 and three, into four different quarters, and we look at what's happening in each of these different quarters, right? So what does what you process in the first quarter, how predictive it is of what you're eventually going to choose? What is it that you do either in the second quarter or the first half as a whole, and how much more prediction you get in terms of what choice you're going to make and so on? And the basic idea is it's sort of related to what you focus on first, but more the way think about it, because I'm not looking only at the first trial, the simpler way to look at it is like in the first quarter of what you do, like what is it that you're focusing on is pretty highly predictive of what you're going to choose subsequently. And then when it comes to the middle two bins, that's the first half and the first three quarter, you start trying to apply other strategies. So if it's like a clear application of your preferred one, the first quarter predicts what you're going to choose. But if there's something in the context that's changing that maybe make you decide like, should I go this way or that way, there's greater processing that happens in the middle two bins. And then the last bin is where sort of the verification stage. You're like, okay, I made up my mind. I want to go see what actually is happening. And that predicts the choice. So you can do like a logistic regression with data from each of the quarters separately and see what is it that's important in that particular quarter of processing. And what I'm trying to say is, in the first quarter, this kind of attention bias is important. In the second and third quarters, it's basically how many across and vertical transitions that you're making. And in the fourth quarter, it's basically verification, which is like all these things together predict what you're going to do. So going back to the question earlier about what happens if you divide people into what their preferred strategy is, right? So we can classify people based on what they're doing into people who are more overall probability maximizers and people who are more of the value maximizers. And we can look at how does the process data change between these different groups of people, okay? So I just have a couple of things here. So the first one is in terms of number of acquisitions, this is really important, right? So all people are going to change at some point. So it's not like they are every single trial going to do PMAX or every single trial going to do the value maximizing strategies. So like I said, there is a point where the expected value changes or other changes in terms of magnitudes makes them want to switch to the other choice, right? So what we did here is we just looked exactly at those switching trials. So if you are somebody who generally prefers probability maximizing choice, but on some trials, you're going to do a different kind of a choice, which is choose the non-probability maximizing option, right? What is happening in those specific trials? And what we find is, not surprisingly, an increase in number of acquisitions. So if you're a value maximizer, when you're making a probability maximizing choice, you see an increase in number of acquisitions, and vice versa for the same. If you're a general PMAX person, you see greater number of acquisitions when you make a value maximizing choice. Okay? So in other words, there is greater effort to stop what you do in general and do something else on these trials because something in the decision environment has changed when you do that. Right? And this is also manifest in terms of the pain index, which is basically an aggregate measure of number of row versus column transitions that you're making. Just simply think of it as that. Right? So for the probability maximizer especially, there is a huge shift in how they process these cells for those trials where their probability maximizing strategy doesn't apply. Right? So essentially what this means is that you, like going back to the earlier argument, if the environment is familiar to you, if you think like basically your preferred strategy works, you just go with it. It's a simpler task to do. But if you choose to do something else different because something in the task environment has changed, there's greater effort and there's greater difference in terms of how you actually process the resulting information as a function of that. Okay? And a further test of this is basically, I mean, just think about this, right? So if you are an overall probability maximizer, what you really care about in the environment is whether the probability maximizing choice is available or not. Right? If you're a value maximizer, you're probably going to be more sensitive to expected value differences because you care about the value. So if the values are changing or if the probabilities of those values are changing, you would care more about that. So it puts a nice testable hypothesis. If this is true, if you're a probability maximizer, all your processing changes should reflect changes for probability maximizing available or not, but not for expected value. And vice versa for the other group of people. Okay? And that's basically what the next slide shows. So here is an example of where I'm holding expected value constant. So in these trials, expected value is not changing, but whether or not an option that changes probability maximizing is available or not. Pardon the, think of P1 as just Pmax. It's just two different terminologies that we have used. Okay? So Pmax available or Pmax is not available. Right? And we have two groups of people, the so-called value maximizers and so-called the overall probability maximizers. And the point to take home from here is most dotted lines are relatively flat in all these graphs. So in terms of number of acquisitions, they don't change much. In terms of the selectivity in how much they are processing, they don't change much. In terms of the pain index, they don't change much. Right? Whereas the probability maximizers really care about whether the P1 is available or not. So in other words, they are shifting their strategies as a function of whether that option that they generally prefer is available to them or is not available to them. Okay? And the flip of this graph, which I don't have here, is if you hold the probability maximizing constant and change the expected value, the solid lines would become flatter and the dotted lines would change, which would be consistent with the fact that these people care about different things in the environment, and based on that, they're willing to shift to other strategies in what they do. And the last point that I want to make is sort of where we are going with this. So this is very new data. Basically, what we are trying to do is do the entire gamut of options. Right? So no longer restricted to two choices, have EV as a completely different choice. So basically, subjects are presented with five different alternatives with five different outcomes. There is the Gmax choice, so this is highest in terms of the gain. There is the Pmax choice, so this is $10 positive versus $10 negative and all the other outcomes. There is the loss minimizing choice, which is minus 45 compared to minus 65. There is one simple decoy option here, which is basically you should never be choosing this because it's dominated by all the other alternatives, so it becomes a nice attention control to make sure subjects are actually paying attention. And we have an EV option here where you're adding $25 or $30 to the system instead of the $20 in all the other outcomes. So you're adding $15 here and another $15 over here, right? So that is going to be the higher EV option. Or we could also change EV by changing these probabilities to make one of these the higher probability. So even if you add the same amount, it's going to be the higher expected value. Okay? And what you have here is a simple choice scenario in this case. What you can see is people are more sensitive to the fact that more money is added. So in this case, it's $10 more. So if we change it to $5 or $10, you'd see the preference go up or down. People are paying attention. So even though this decision is so complex, the fact that people are really not choosing this more than like 2% of the trials across 40 people, and each one is doing about 15 trials, it makes us feel like, okay, the task is working. It's not that people are choosing completely randomly. And there is still a strong preference for the Pmax. It's not as strong as before, but now you have to realize you have five different outcomes. So the random choice would be like 0.2. Yep. What's interesting once you go to these complex gambles, and this is something that we are now exploring, is you can do much more with the dynamics of the data. Okay? So for example, instead of doing a quarter-based analysis, because this is a difficult problem, people take about 40 to 50 acquisitions on each single trial to make their decision. So now what you can do is rather than splitting it into four bins, you can split it into 10 bins and see what's happening as the process evolves. Okay? And what's really interesting to see is, so here what you have is the different lines represent the attention paid to the different alternatives as a function of what's chosen. So in this trial, if the subject chooses Gmax, you can see the green line that's associated with the gain maximizing alternative basically start getting greater and greater attention as early as the third bin. Okay, and it holds for all the other choices. So if you're choosing an EV, the G2, which is the expected value option, gets attention really early on. Basically, people catch on to it, they process more and more of it, verify that it's working, and then basically make the choice that corresponds to it. And the same with probability maximizing, but you don't see it with the decoy, which is obviously what you would expect, right? But this is interesting because what now you can do is you can use this point of deviation where clearly the eventual choice starts separating out statistically from all the other choices and use that as a marker for how early in the process are you zoning in on the option that's most interesting to you, right? So for example, if you're manipulating states, if you have like a happy versus a sad state, you can use this as a kind of diagnosis to see, like for example, the prediction would be people in the anger or happy conditions would start showing differences much early on because they just choose the first one that they like. Whereas the sad people who are generally known to be more compensatory, consider all the things that are presented to you in the environment, these lines would be separating much later in the process. Okay? So it becomes a sort of a diagnostic tool to see like how you're processing this information, how early does your eventual choice become the winner in terms of what gets eventually chosen, those sorts of analysis. Okay? So this is some things that are possible because of the fact that the tasks are getting more complex, but at the same time, it has clear diagnostic properties in terms of what you would predict in different states and different individuals. All right, so just to summarize, in addition to that, basically we show that there are some clear systematic differences associated with the strategic differences we see in terms of what people choose, both in terms of we saw in the terms of choice in the first few behavioral studies, and we saw that clearly illustrated in terms of processing differences from eye tracking in the second study. Okay? Then the next question that we asked ourselves was, what about the underlying neural mechanisms? Right? So in other words, especially with respect to the shift between the various strategies that you're using, is there some clear manifestation of this in the brain? Are there regions that track this additional control that's needed for the fact that you do some preferred choice on most trials, but on certain trials you want to change based on the fact that the task environment has changed or the decision environment has changed? I think the reason why we chose Pmax is because of the fact that it's something that's very clear for more complex multi-outcome gambles. If you just do like the simple heuristics that people use with just two outcomes, There are cases where it works, the magnitudes become important, and so on. But here you have something which is psychologically different from what the entire processing approach in this particular strategy is different, right? Because you're not focusing on the magnitudes anymore. The individual probabilities don't matter. All you care about is like the overall chance of success or failure. So if you have a certain aspiration level, you want to meet that. All you care about is like, how well can I meet my aspiration level? How well can I walk out with something positive out of it? So that's why it's interesting. And in terms of the big picture, the key question here is trying to understand what's the best way to think about people's variability, right? Of course, there are people who would argue that everything is a parameter in a model. You can fit different parameters and you can explain this variability, right? So you can take the CPT, you can change two parameters, you can fit it to individuals and say all this variability can be captured by the change in that parameter, right? But sometimes the flip argument is it's not something as simple, because the way you approach a problem could be a different set of rules or a different set of strategies. You try to do one thing first. If that works, that's all you do. If that doesn't work, you may go and do a second thing, which may be a CPT or an expected utility. And then you may do a completely different thing, right? So the idea is, if that's what you're doing, then the parameter approach doesn't work. It's actually clearly different strategies in terms of different levels of processing, in terms of different regions that are active in the brain. And you can also see what happens when you're shifting between these different strategies. So the eventual goal is to use a different methodological approach to get to the point that people are probably doing not just simple single model applications, but people are actually switching between these different strategies based on what their underlying preferences are and based on the exact context in which the information is presented. All right, so the same task, slight changes for fMRI. We just show them the Bayes gamble. And then we give them two specific choices that they can make, which are highlighted in this case in red. And the only difference is basically we show them this for a certain amount of time, and then we basically present arrows to say which response to press for which one they want to choose. And the reason for doing this is we wanted to keep the response-related activation different from the decision-related activation. So for all purposes, we are most interested in what happens when subjects are deciding here. And then the last one is just like which button they press. So that's kept separate from the actual decision phase. Okay? So in terms of what you would expect, there are several ways in which you can think about this, right? So if you just use the classic notion of how heuristic goes, like the system one, system two kind of thinking, right? Then the basic idea would be that you have a rational cognitive system two, and then you have the hot emotional system one, right? Which is basically trying to do something quickly, do things as fast as possible. You choose the sure but often tempting option. It's a faster response, and so on and so forth, right? So the idea is this dominates this, but in some case, I mean, and then you can slowly bring this into play to overcome what your system one urges you to do, right? So this is the more emotional system. This is the more rational cognitive system, and together they lead to choice. And this is an extremely popular model, both in behavior as well as neuroscience. A few examples here, but there are many more examples of similar kinds of models, be it in terms of the model decision making, be it in terms of framing. You can think of this in most of the tasks where something like this works. Okay, so if we just directly apply it in principle to what we have been talking before, then one prediction would be that this system is more to do with the carefully playing, looking at all the information that's presented to you, choosing things that are more consistent with models, and so on and so forth. So this would be more the value-focused choices, and this would be more about the heuristic choices. Okay? But a completely different way to think about this is not just in terms of what you choose, but more about what is it that's important for the kind of processes that you're doing, right? So if you go back to the eye tracking data, we clearly see differential attention being paid to specific attributes as a function of what you choose. So that means what should be driving these activations is more activation in the loss-related regions if you choose a loss-minimizing choice, more activation in the gain-seeking or the high-risk regions when you're choosing a gain-maximizing choice, and more activation in the more computing regions, like, for example, calculating the overall probability or something like that when you're choosing the probability-maximizing choice. Right? So the alternative hypothesis is what drives these activation is the underlying computations, not really is it like consistent with this choice or consistent with this model and so on and so forth. Okay? So based on what I'm leading you towards, what we find is what I said later. So we find a greater evidence in terms of what drives activations in these regions is more about underlying processes, which fits in very nicely with eye tracking data, and I'll try to highlight it as I'm going along, right? So, but here's the basic data. So what we see is we see greatest activation in the insula when you're most likely to choose a loss minimizing choice. So the yellow one is the loss minimizing here. We see greatest activation in the ventromedial prefrontal cortex when you're choosing a gain maximizing choice. Okay? So this is a region that's been shown in several different studies to be associated with negative emotion, and so that would be consistent with what we find here. And this is greater value processing and shows subjective valuation and so on. So that would be again consistent with the gain maximizing choice. And what we find is the parietal, and also not shown here, but the dorsolateral prefrontal region show greater activation for the probability maximizing choice, consistent with the fact that even though people are not trading off actual values, there's some kind of a counting, base counting going on, where you're counting like the number of good and number of bad attributes. And that's essentially what's driving your activation in those regions. Okay? And what's really interesting is, even though these are data from two different studies, it's very interesting to look at how they go with each other, right? So if you remember the data from eye tracking, this is basically what we found. In terms of the various attributes, greatest attention to the win attribute predicts the gain maximizing choice, the intermediate choice, and the loss minimizing choice, right? And if I take the imaging data, I can basically substitute these labels with activation in VMPFC, with activation in the parietal cortex, and with activation in the insula. And this data would be completely consistent with that. Okay, because that's basically the pattern that we find from the imaging studies too, which fits nicely with what is the underlying process or what is the underlying mechanism. So it's not just a simple reverse inference, or everybody else has shown insula, we show insula for loss minimizing choice, so that's what they're paying attention to. But you also have like additional process evidence now to say, like, look, it is driven by the losses, and if you took it out of the scanner and actually measured what people are focusing their attention on, it is going to be driven by the fact that they care more about the loss attributes when you do that. You have a question, Ted? All right. Okay? And the next important thing is, like I said, The most interesting thing with this is what happens when people switch, what happens when people change away from their preferred strategy, right? And so what we look for is basically regions where if you took the strategic variability in terms of like if you just normalized it to the more Pmax or more value maximizing choices and you looked at activation in regions of the brain, is there a particular region that co-varies with this change in preference? Like how much do they prefer the probability maximizing or not? And what we find is this region in the dorsomedial prefrontal cortex, where the story is basically the same. This region is not greater for any particular choice, but it kicks in when you want to switch away from your preferred alternative, right? So if in general you're a value maximizer, you see greater activation when you make a probability maximizing choice. If in general you're a probability maximizer, you see greater activation when you make a value maximizing choice. Okay? So The way to think about this, again, this would be consistent with the process data that we had. So if you look at the number of acquisitions, we see the same pattern to what you see over here. So all this data nicely fits in with each other in terms of how converging it is. Okay? But a way to think about this activation is basically this. So you can do something called a functional connectivity analysis, where you can define this as a seed region, and you can see what other regions are moving with it as a function of what choice you make. Right? So you can look at what regions are functionally connected to this as a function of when you make a value maximizing choice. And not surprisingly, what we find is greater activation in the insula when you do that. So there's stronger functional connectivity between the dorsomedial prefrontal cortex and the insula only for the value maximizing trials. Similarly, there's stronger connectivity between the dorsomedial prefrontal cortex and the parietal region only when people are making the probability maximizing choice. Okay, so that's what's summarized here. So you see stronger connectivity with the insula for value maximizing choice, stronger connectivity in the parietal for the probability maximizing choice. Okay, so what this means is essentially, I mean, the way to think about this in a very simplistic manner is that this region acts like a switch. If you're doing the same thing, what your preferred strategy is, if say you're a probability maximizer, right? On a trial, you come to this region, you do a probability maximizing choice, it just has to select this. That's your default option. There's no greater effort that's needed. But because of changes in the task environment, let's say you're going to switch your preferred choice to something else, then this region increases its activation and sort of flips from here to here, chooses this network now instead of the previously preferred network, right? So that explains the increased activation and the change to a different network, which is now more active based on the choice that you're going to make. Okay? So one way to think about this is think of it as some kind of a control region. So the more you do things that you prefer, there's really not much for it to do because there's no greater control that's needed. But when you have to inhibit your preferred strategy now, it's not just a preferred response, but your preferred strategy, then you see greater activation in this region and you switch to the other region that's involved in what you want to do. Okay? And the last point that I want to make, which goes back to the earlier question about how people feel about these. So the way this experiment is set up is they make all these choices one after the other, but they do not get any feedback at that point. So what, and it was done because we didn't want the effects of feedback to be confounded with what they actually choose. So we tell them, you're eventually going to know what happens on these trials, but for now, make each one of these as if it's an independent trial, right? But while they are still in the scanner, we randomly selected a subset of their choices and played it out. So here they're just passively lying on the scanner. They can see what was the outcome based on a random number that's drawn by a computer, okay? So we converted the probabilities into ball numbers. So 1 to 20 is 80, 21 to 45 is 40. So this represents the probabilities. And so it's like randomly drawing a ball from 1 to 100 from a cage. That's how we explain it to the participant, right? So on this trial, basically, subliminally, some number changes here for about 2 seconds, then it stops, a number is displayed, and then the summary tells them what happened on the trial. Okay? And what we wanted to do was basically look at how people treat the valence of whether they win or they do not win on these trials. Right? And what we find is a very strong effect, not surprisingly, in the ventral striatum. And this is not a novel result. Several people have shown sensitivity in this region to whether you win or lose. Right? This is the primary dopaminergic target. Several studies have shown that this region is sensitive to actual outcomes, reward outcomes. But what's really interesting is the magnitude of difference in this region for gains and losses correlates very nicely across participants with how often they choose the probability maximizing or value maximizing choices. In other words, the probability maximizers are more sensitive to whether they win or not. Right? So interpreting this, going back to the earlier point that you raised, it means that they really care. They regret more when they don't win, and they care when they actually win. The magnitude doesn't matter. It's just the valence. Did I win or did I not win on this trial? Right? So the people who are using this probability maximizing strategy really care more about the actual outcomes, which is what we have here. The difference is larger for the more probability maximizers compared to the more value maximizers, who basically are not really that sensitive to the actual win or loss on these trials. Okay, so this is another way to interpret the same data, saying what's driving the strategy is basically like sort of minimizing the regret that they're going to feel based on the fact that they didn't win the amount that they were expecting to win. Okay, so just to summarize, distinct neural systems potentiate choices depending on context and strategy, but more importantly, the dorsal medial prefrontal cortex exerts some kind of a strategic influence or does the strategic control based on what people are choosing. Okay. So I guess till 1:15 is what I have. All right. I want to quickly show how this fits in with the broader cognitive control literature, which I think is very interesting. So I'm going to try to do that and basically maybe skip on the sleep deprivation stuff. This is not new. People in neuroscience have been studying cognitive control for a very long time. And there is a lot of studies that focus on this particular region. Sometimes people just call it more the anterior cingulate cortex. But it's in the vicinity of this region. There's been a lot of attention before in terms of what it does. Right? So how do these things fit together? Or what can all these studies about decision neuroscience bring to the greater literature about cognitive control in general? Right? So cognitive control, like I said, there are several definitions, but essentially the idea is that you want to change something based on changes in the environment, right? Simply, you have to control something, you have to update your representation, and you do something different as a result of that, okay? So what we try to do is extend it to the notion of what we call strategic control, where it's essentially control, but for different strategies. So you have several strategies that's available to you, and you switch between these strategies as a function of changes in the task environment, Okay, so it's similar to control, but it's slightly more abstract. It's not at the level of response, it's not level of simple decisions, but it's more at the level of what your preferred strategy is and how you switch between these different strategies. Okay, so in this follow-up study, we broke cognitive control into three levels. First is a simple response-related control. So this is like the Stroop task, this is like the go-no-go task, where you keep doing something constantly and then you have to stop your response, right? So it's all completely at the level of motor presses or the response. The second level is what we call is decision control. So this is more in terms of how difficult is the decision that you're making, right? So the harder the decision, the greater the control that you need to make sure you're making the right choice. Okay, so if you're choosing between two things that are very similar, it's much harder when you're choosing between two things that are really different. And so the choice is very obvious. And the third one is, of course, like I said, the strategy control. So inhibiting more about a prepotent strategy because something is different in the task environment. Okay? So we tried to vary all these three different types of control in the same subjects, in the same scanning session, so that we could see how does all this tie into the broader literature about the dorsomedial prefrontal cortex. Okay? So there are several studies, several reviews. There is like some studies that argue for a more cognitive versus a more emotional distinction. There are some studies, meta-analysis, that seem to say like most of these are essentially like all over the cingulate cortex. There's no clear hierarchical organization. So what we did was we did our own meta-analysis. So we just took all the studies that focus only on responses. We took a set of studies that focus on decision-making and activation in this region and ran a simple likelihood-based meta-analysis in terms of where the activation would lie. And what we found was the response studies were more posterior, so the blue refers to the more response-related studies. And in terms of the decision studies, we saw two big peaks. One is more rostral, and one is slightly more anterior to what we saw with the responses. Okay? But at first insight, basically by looking, this is across 60 different studies, 30 in each cell, there seems to be some kind of a clear dissociation on where the peaks lie in terms of anterior-posterior in the brain. Okay? So this got us interested, and we were wondering if we systematically had a task that evaluated all these three things, would you see a clear topography in terms of what's happening within this region? So that's basically where we tried to go with this study. So we did a response-related task. So this is like a simplified version of the Stroop task. You see multiple representations of the word. You just say how many times is the word repeated, right? So in this case, you say three. It's easy to count because it's a neutral word. It's just a simple counting task. In this case, it's again a simple counting task. The right answer is three, but because the word presented is two, you have a prepotent tendency to say two, and you have to inhibit that and say it's actually three, right? So it's simple incongruent stimuli versus congruent stimuli. Okay? And what we can see is basically, if you contrast what's happening in the incongruent versus congruent with how much time the subject is taking, so the variability in terms of how well they suppress this data, you see clear activation in a slightly posterior region of the dorsomedial prefrontal cortex. That basically tracks the variability in response time versus how much activation you have for that signal within that region. Right? Now, the next thing that we wanted to do was to vary the decision and strategic variability. Right? We wanted to use this as a way to also replicate our study from the first experiment, where we had these gambles and we had these two different strategies. So we try to use a different task where it doesn't have the same probability information, it still has some kinds of numbers, and there are two different things that you could do in the task, right? So the one we picked was a simple market task. So the way we set this up for the subject is think of this as on each trial, you're choosing between three hypothetical stocks that are rated on two different attributes, right? So these could be things like the performance of the stock in the last quarter, and so on and so forth. We gave them a few different examples for what they mean. But we simplified it so much that essentially what the subject is deciding between is a set of two different attributes that have numbers from 1 to 100, 100 meaning it's really good on this particular attribute, 1 meaning it's really poor in that particular attribute, right? And you're given three different stocks, but essentially your choice comes down to choosing between the two, okay, which has kept the structure as similar to possible to the first study that we did, okay? Now, there are two things that you can do in these trials, okay? So let me just focus on that. So one option is basically a balanced option, which means that particular stock is reasonably good on both attributes, right? So it's balanced, it's good on both attributes. Relative to another option, that's more of an extreme option where it's better on one attribute, but poorer on a different attribute, okay? And in addition to the balanced option, we can also vary the expected value, which is basically, in this case, the sum of the two attributes together, right? So in this case, clearly B is better because the sum is 125 compared to the fact that here the sum is 120. Okay, so the simple heuristic is extremeness aversion. So in general, people are averse to extreme outcomes. They prefer things that are more balanced, right? So there's a lot of literature on that in terms of what you do. Or you could basically do some kind of a calculation in terms of expected value and choose what you want to do. Okay, so across trials, we varied the difficulty. So you have some congruent trials where the expected value and the balanced option both point to the same choice. So not surprisingly, almost always people are choosing the balanced option. In some trials, you have a very clear expected value. So the expected value is better than the balanced choice. So in that case, people choose the more of the expected value choice. And in the third one is where there is a conflict. So there's no clear expected value. So in this case, you should go with the balanced choice, which is what you do in these cases. But it's still slightly lesser than what you would see if the balanced choice is also higher expected value. But in terms of simple difficulty, we see a clear difference in response time. So people find these categories the hardest. Here they simply apply the heuristic rule. Here they simply apply the EV rule. Here the EV rule is not available, so they decide what they want to do and they can flip between both those different choices. And what we can do is we can look for brain regions that mimic this effect, where there is greatest activation for the most difficult one compared to the middle one. And not surprisingly, we again find it in the dorsal medial prefrontal cortex, but it's slightly more anterior to what you find for the response-related stuff. So this is what I call a decision-related control or a task difficulty effect. Okay? And the last one is just mimicking the strategy thing. So what we can do is we can take people who generally prefer the balanced outcome versus people who don't, right? So you can get a continuum in terms of strategy preference. What they prefer the most versus what they prefer the least. So it's sort of saying the Pmax and the Vmax. Here in this case, it's the balancing heuristic versus the non-balancing heuristic, right? So you get the variability across participants. You can co-vary it, and you see activation again in the dorsal medial prefrontal cortex that's most anterior to the other two things that we see, right? So if I put all this together, just to say, like, are these two different? So this is the red one is the decision one. This is the one that's for strategy. These look awfully close to each other, but is there clear differences in terms of what these regions are doing? There is. So in the case of this one, you see for the decision, there's a clear parametric effect in the middle DMPFC, but not in the anterior DMPFC. In terms of strategy, you see a much stronger strategy effect or a correlation with strategy for the green region, but not for the red region. Okay? So there seems to be a clear functional dissociation in terms of what these two regions are doing. And you can put all this together in terms of where we are. So the red is the response, the blue is the response, the red is the decision, and the green is the strategy. And there seems to be a nice topography in terms of where they lie along the dorsal medial prefrontal cortex. And the little squares here are the peak activations from the meta-analysis. And so it nicely maps on to what you find in the meta-analysis. Okay? The only unknown factor here is what's happening to this region here. My speculation is that this has to do with more emotional aspects of decision making. So if we had a task where there is more greater requirement for emotional control, you would see that basically lying somewhere more rostral, similar to what you see at the second red peak associated with.
And that's what you meant by supposed to be MPSC, or is that rostral?
It's rostral ACC more, so it's like a little more, yeah. Okay? And I'm just going to end with this, but basically, this thing is new for the dorsal medial prefrontal cortex, but there has been a similar hierarchy postulated in the lateral prefrontal cortex. So the lateral regions of the brain, people have shown a similar hierarchy, where as you go more posterior to anterior, things get more abstract. So the more posterior one is, again, simple, choose a button versus another button. Whereas here, it's more like relational. You have to hold things in. If it's green, then you press the red button. If you press the left button. If it's blue, press the right button, right? That sort of relationships where you have to remember, like, what round am I in? What is it that I'm supposed to choose? Involves more of the anterior kinds of regions in the brain, right? So that would fit very nicely because the simple response control, again, is the more simple things that you do, more concrete kind of tasks, and the more abstract things is related to strategy, where it actually is you have a preferred one, and then you change based on changes in the task environment. Right? So then what we asked ourselves was, is there basically a similar hierarchy also in the connections between these regions? Right? So you see a gradient in the lateral, you see a gradient in the medial, are they also similar gradient in terms of how these regions are connected to each other? Because that would fit very nicely with the fact that often this is postulated to be the monitoring region, so it monitors for changes in the environment, it monitors for do I need to change something in what I do, and these are more postulated to be the execution regions. Like this implements the changes that are needed based on the changes that are detected by the medial regions. Right? So if that's true, you should see similar differences in the connectivity between these regions. So for this, we just did a simple resting state connectivity. So we just took a brain when subjects are just not doing any task, and we looked for are there intrinsic differences in the connections between these different regions. Right? So we defined seed regions that lie along the lateral part of the brain and then related to what's happening in the medial. So you define a seed region, and then you see what else in the brain is correlated with the seed region. Right? And what you can see is a nice gradient where for the more posterior seeds, you see more posterior activation in the medial prefrontal cortex. And for the more anterior seeds, you can see the shift to more anterior regions. Right? And you can flip this whole thing. You can define the seeds in the medial, and you can see what's happening in the lateral. And you would see similar kind of an effect if you did that. Okay? So that's basically what you have here. So you have the seeds defined in the medial, and you see basically a posterior to anterior gradient in terms of what's happening in the lateral prefrontal cortex. So what this says is this connectivity is not, this topography is not just restricted to each one, but it's also manifests itself in terms of like the connections between these different regions. So if we had to have like an updated model of control, it would look something like this. So you have uncertainty in the environment that gets detected by the medial prefrontal cortex, and that varies topographically by which level you want, at simple action level, at the decision level, or at a more strategic level, right? And then this feeds into the more lateral regions, but again, the more anterior feeds to more anterior and more posterior feeds to more posterior. And this basically makes the changes in the current environment or whatever changes need to be updated. And this again changes based on abstraction or different levels of difficulty in what you're trying to do. Right? Yeah. So that's basically how you can take some things with more complex tasks in decision neuroscience and use it to sort of understand the larger theories of cognitive control or cognitive neuroscience. Right? And I'm basically going to stop here because I'm out of time. So I'm going to skip the sleep deprivation part. Maybe I'll just go to my acknowledgement slide, make sure I acknowledge the people. And I'll give you like a priming of what I did with the sleep deprivation. All right, thanks. Oh.